The Senate Arctic Committee is called to order. We have a quorum to conduct business. Co-chair Senator Geisel, myself, Senator Olson, and Senator Bishop. Good morning. Okay, we just we're reconvening the meeting that we held last Thursday, and when we took a recess at that moment, we had HB1 in front of us. So let's bring that back before us. And that's all we're going to do today is move that resolution out, that bill out, and then we're going to have a presentation on Arctic maritime safety. So it's before us right now. There was an amendment that had been offered by Senator Bishop, and I had objected to it for purposes of discussion. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I'd like to offer
a refined amendment.
So can you withdraw amendment
yes.
one?
Yes, so I'll withdraw amendment number one.
Okay, and so now you're offering amendment two?
I'm offering amendment number two.
Okay, and that's being distributed here. Okay, and I'll object just to hear you talk about it.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, after consultation with some of the other members and Senator Geisel's office, I'll just read the amendment for into the record. Under Section 2AS 44.99.105.1, Section G, continue to prepare all Alaskans for emerging economic activities by utilizing multiple education and training opportunities and implementing state workforce plans. I think that it tightens it up and captures everything we were saying with the other amendments. So I think this gets us where we want to go, and is consistent with the overarching policy document that was put out by the council.
Thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to withdraw my objection. Appreciate all your work on this, Senator Bishop and Senator Geisel. Any further discussion? Okay, hearing and seeing none, then amendment number two carries. And now we have the bill back before us, and we do have one person, Kara Moriarty, who wants to testify. How are you, Kara?
Yeah, thank you, Senator, and the rest of the committee. This will be brief. Good morning. For the record, my name is Kara Moriarty, and I'm the President and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, as you all know, commonly referred to as AOGA. We are the professional trade association whose mission is to foster the long-term viability of the oil and gas industry for the benefit of all Alaskans. Our members have been exploring, developing, producing, transporting, and refining Alaska's natural resources in the Arctic for more than 40 years. And we're proud of our partnership with the people of Alaska, providing revenue to the state, economic opportunities, and infrastructure to the Arctic region. I just wanted to be on record to publicly thank the Alaska Arctic Policy Commission and its 26 members for the substantial amount of work that you have all undertaken the past 2 years. The outcome, both the report and the implementation plan and this bill, is to be commended as a robust and comprehensive view of Alaska's Arctic. Both of these documents, along with the current bill, place the people of the Arctic in the forefront and reiterate Alaska's commitment to vibrant communities through a healthy environment and economic stability. Since statehood, as you all know, the industry has fueled our economy by providing jobs to Alaskans and revenues for the state and local funding. And today, the oil and gas industry still accounts for more than 92% of the state's general unrestricted fund and 99% of the revenues to the North Slope boroughs. While we were not an official member of the commission, AOGA was proudly and actively engaged in the Alaska Arctic Policy Commission's process over the last 2 years. Our comments were focused on two main tenets in the Arctic: access and predictability. Whether advocating for Anilka lands, development of ANWR and MPRA, or OCS development, the industry has partnered with the state to uphold and defend multiple use of Arctic public lands for development that would lead to immense potential for supporting Arctic economies, filling the Trans-Alaska pipeline, and generating billions of dollars in government revenues. Although access to land is itemized in the implementation plan, We do appreciate your renewed commitment to that in your policies. We've long fought for predictability in development and stable tax, regulatory, and permitting processes encourage investment and drive economically vibrant communities. The oil and gas industry just finally has been commended by the people of the Arctic for the outreach efforts and integration of traditional knowledge and industry operations. And many companies have dedicated tribal liaisons who spend considerable time in these communities. The bottom line is our members engage with Arctic communities every day, and we look forward to continuing to do so for years to come. We thank you for your leadership, both of the co-chairs of this committee, and I see Representative Heron is in the room for his leadership as well. And I thank you for the opportunity to just put that on the record.
Thank you so much, Kara. We really appreciate that. Any comments, questions for Kara? And Senator Coghill has joined us. Okay, so Senator Giesel.
Well, I just want to take a moment, Madam Co-Chair, to thank Kara, the AOGA, the Miners Association, the Support Industry Alliance, Resource Development Council, all of whom contributed significant comment to this document and really helped keep our awareness of where economic development comes from and where the protection of our environment, frankly, comes from these industries that know what the standards are. The standards that we enforce. So I just want to thank her publicly and those organizations. Thank you.
Wonderful. And I join that thanks as well. I know Representative Heron does too. There's so many people, so many hands on the deck. Kara, you were at so many of the meetings and contributed as well, so appreciate your work. Okay, so we have an available motion, Senator Giesel.
To move the bill?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I move the Senate CS for CS for House Bill Number 1, version 29LS0013, I have S, Sierra, as amended with amendment number 2, from this committee to the next with individual recommendations.
Okay, is there any objection to that motion? Okay, hearing and seeing none, the CS as amended has moved with individual recommendations. Thank you. And so the only other thing we have, thank you, Representative here, and thank you all. The only other thing we have today so we can finish on time is a presentation on the Arctic maritime safety with Ed Page. Ed, welcome to our committee. If you put yourself on the record, but I am so excited to have you today.
Well, I'm excited
thank
to have
you.
The opportunity. I appreciate it.
For the members that have not gotten a chance to see what Ed Page is up to, this is a really great presentation. Okay, we're taking a brief at ease for technical. Okay, welcome, Captain Page.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity, and the co-chairs and the rest of the committee here. This wouldn't exist, the capabilities we're going to talk about here for the next 15-20 minutes, wouldn't exist if it was not for the support of the Alaska State Legislature. So I want to show you the deliverables that we've been developing over the last several years. For background purposes, I was in the Coast Guard for some 33 years and first came up here in 73 on a Coast Guard cutter after sailing on the North Atlantic. I thought I'd try the Pacific for a while in Alaska. And over the course of my Coast Guard career, I had a lot of search and rescue cases and environmental incidents that happened that were pretty tragic consequences. And worked in cases where ships sank with all hands and 43 people perished, to the Exxon Valdez oil spill. I worked on that for 3 years, and the Glacier Bay oil spill in the year beforehand that, and many other incidents. So over the years, I became a real believer in preventing incidents. And we talk about, obviously, the safety and loss of life concerns, environmental concerns. But as we learned with the accident recently with the Shell incident, it also has economic impacts for job stop and the progress that your committee has been working on, and others in the state legislature, to help develop our resources, come to all stop if we can't do it responsibly. And so there's an obligation on the industry to be proactive. There's also an obligation on the agencies, the Coast Guard and state agencies, to provide that oversight to compel compliance with risk mitigating measures, environmental protection. So I'm going to talk about how we've developed this with the state funding and Coast Guard and maritime industry funding, these capabilities that should help ensure that we do things in a safe, environmentally sound manner. And so, unfortunately, this thing's behind you. I don't know if another way of looking at it. You have monsters, but oh, you have monsters. Terrific. So I can, technology is a wonderful thing.
It is.
In which case, I'll proceed.
And
I'll have to spin your heads around, talk to back your heads. That's terrific. So I'm going to talk about how we're using, I'm big into leveraging technology. At one point in my career, I was the captain of the port for Los Angeles and Long Beach. And I realized that I really couldn't be very effective unless I had a vessel tracking capability. I could just lock myself in the closet, turn off the lights, and guess, or I could have tools to actually use information. So I became somewhat obsessed, if you will, with this vessel tracking capability. Coast Guard didn't have those resources, so I worked with the state of California in that case, and the ports, and the maritime industry, and the Coast Guard developed the capability. That model worked. I subsequently went to Chief of Marine Safety of the Pacific area, and then got out of the Coast Guard, specifically developed a marine exchange for Alaska. So I've got about 25 years of Alaska experience now in maritime, 43 years in the maritime industry and Coast Guard altogether. So bringing that knowledge, and hopefully it now makes sense, starting to come clear to me as far as the tools and the process that we can do to enhance maritime safety in the most challenging maritime state in our nation. There's no state more maritime than Alaska and more diverse than Alaska. So we have a big challenge in a huge area, and thanks to everyone pulling together, and when I say everyone, it's the state, the Coast Guard, and maritime industry, shared commitment. So the slides talk about that. We are a nonprofit maritime organization, and we're located in Juneau, right around the street. And I extend an invite to all of you, anytime you want to come by, Saturday, Sunday, night, please do. We have a 24-hour operations center. We'd be glad to show you around. In many exchanges, maybe a better term is exchanging maritime information. They go back to the 1800s. They use spyglasses and semaphore to disseminate information to facilitate trade. We're more sophisticated now. Back then, they used to have these chalkboards on the streets that tell you when the ships are coming in so you can conduct efficient trade. When I was the Coast Guard, I would call them in exchange if I had to board a ship to find out when it was coming in, how we get on it, when the pilot boat was leaving, what have you. So it's a broker of information. So instead of chalkboards, I'm pleased to say we moved beyond that. iPhones and iPads and other tools, computer tools. So
we've got a question here, and just also before I get to that, I wanted to note on the record for some time we've had Senator Stevens with us as well. Senator Bishop.
Just one question, sure. And I don't want to ask any more, but I think I'm going to make a comment, and I would like you to myth bust this for me. You know, you make reference to the chalkboard, and that's how we track ships, but I would say as a layman, that the maritime industry has impeccable records, written records, that you can record shipping as far back as in the 1400s.
Yeah. Well, I do. And the challenge now, of course, is when vessels cast off all lines, they just disappeared over the horizon. We had no idea what they were doing. And then suddenly they show up on our beach, such as the case of Selden IU. We had no idea. It was suddenly says, we need help, and they didn't. You wait till the last minute until the extremist to call for help. That would not happen again. You cannot replicate that situation because now we call them. The moment they slow down, we say, why are you slowing down? We have a destination? And they say, well, small problem with engine. Okay, we're going to call the Coast Guard. We're going to look for tugboats. We're going to evaluate the weather. Happens every day. So we're basically, there's maritime domain awareness. We're looking very closely at this. So the technology is really a force multiplier. If Hazel was being watched, he probably wouldn't have left the channel. But he knew he was beyond the eye of the Coast Guard. There was no radar there. So as a result, it's kind of like people when they know there's no police coverage for a stretch of highway. They might go faster than the speed limit. So what we're finding out is by monitoring, it's influencing behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Captain Page, as you're talking about some of these accidents, I realize that Hazelwood and Sundang Ayu are one of the things. How do we stay away from the Costa Concordia type situation where Scatino essentially wasn't even on the bridge at the time, but he still had a disastrous outcome with 32 people that were dead?
Yes, sir. I think that, well, we don't have the panacea, and there's no such thing as 100% reducing risk, but I think the mere fact, if mariners knew that their home office had the capability and are in fact monitoring, they could see a trend that this captain is steering very close to shore. That's a high-risk evolution. Pack your bags. We're going to find someone who manages the risk. So what we're doing now is not trusting all the mariners, but actually nudging them and monitoring them, and they know they're being monitored. Ask permission if they want to vary from areas now. So it's a system that has not existed before. In fact, we developed the largest, a retired admiral who's now the chief of American Bureau of Shipping for the North Americas, North and South America, who travels worldwide. He came this last summer, and he went, and he knew me from years ago. He used to actually work for me, and he heard me talking about this marine exchange concept. And he stood in an operations center and says, there's nothing like this in the world. This is the largest vessel compliance monitoring system in the world. I said, I know, we overshot the mark. We didn't quite intend to be there, but this is a new concept, and it's adopted in Alaska. So, and it's getting a lot. I just came back from Ottawa. On there, they paid the ticket. Canada's very interested in what we're doing here. So, it's something that's taken hold that hasn't existed beforehand. So, this certainly makes dramatic increases. The biggest increase I've seen in enhancing maritime safety and preventing incidents is what's existing right here in Alaska. But we haven't totally locked the barn door.
Yeah. Madam Chair, if I can continue, my real question has to do not so much with disasters like Costa Concordia, which essentially got off course or was a lot closer to danger than anticipated. But even if we look at our own ferry system here 10 years ago, less than 100 miles from here, there was a grounding of one of the ferries over there. And how do we avoid that type of situation?
I know there's still we talk about prevention to people. Ultimately, it's the mariners are left in charge just like they are aircraft. But if they're monitored, and they're managed by their home office and the port captains and other people, they're less likely to take high-risk events because people can intervene real-time. I mean, we have alarms go off on vessels in the wrong areas.
They plan to have monitors right in the wheelhouse itself?
Well, the wheelhouse knows exactly where they are. It's whether they're paying attention where they are. Mm-hmm. But we are seeing vessels every couple seconds. Their positions updated every couple seconds in our operations center. And that's available to, my iPhone, iPads, to those who are in charge, who are supposed to oversee the vessels, was the port captain or the fleet manager or the...
My last question, Madam Chairman, has to do, there's two of us here on the Finance Committee. Obviously, the state's in a situation that it can ill afford some of those improvements that, I think you think are necessary, but how do we go ahead and circumvent that situation where state assets are... being called into question?
Are you referring to like the ferry system or just
the ferry system?
Any
particular. Because that's what we have to pay for.
Yes, sir. Basically all the systems we're talking about are in place in the ferry system right now. What I'm going to talk about today is up and running. It's not something we're building. It's in existence. The capability exists. It's really more of a management issue as far as monitoring what people are doing. So,
Chairman.
Yeah.
No further
Absolutely.
Questions.
That's great.
Okay. So, just get a feel for traffic. We have a lot of traffic out, and that's just one shot and one moment of what's going out there. I had no idea that stuff was, when I was Chief of Marine Safety, I had no idea that kind of traffic was out there. So sometimes it's better, ignorance was bliss, there's some merit to that whole thing.
I bet you have some sleepless nights, huh? Because you can pull it up anytime, right, on your iPad.
Absolutely. It's available all the time. In fact, when the incident happened on the rig, Admiral Osabo called and said, what's my username and password again? Because I want to go home. I'm sick and tired of being up here in the operations center. I want to watch this home with a beer and uniform off. So why we track Russell's, clearly safety net, risk assessments, environmental protection, validate compliance, emerge response, efficiency, security, you know, many reasons why we would do this. And ultimately, safe, secure, efficient, environmentally sound maritime operations is our goal. And as Senator Olson kind of alluded to, 99.99% success is not really good enough. We can't say we had that. People aren't comfortable with that. The Concordia, you can't come up with that argument. Well, we've had 99.99% success or with tankers. It's a very high standard on the industry and the agencies, the oversight agencies. And so I said before, this is a shared marine industry, Coast Guard, State of Alaska commitment, involvement, and all of which support. The state users of our information, Fish and Game, DOT, Emergency Services, Department of Emergency Services, Community and Economic Development, ADEC, many different applications of the information we're providing are used by a suite of government agencies. And I was in Canada the last couple of days upon their invitation, actually paid my way to Ottawa, so otherwise I wouldn't spend that much money to be freezing cold. And this place is colder than Alaska, and that's Ottawa is one of them. But when you look at what they have, their objectives and their goals line up totally with ours. And they are very interested in what we're doing here in Alaska and trying to replicate the same type of safety net. But they talk about climate change, expanded resource development, community resupply, and tourism, and increased traffic, and what have you. So this aligns with what your goals are in your report, as well as the Coast Guard goals as far as working with industry, international engagement, and applying new technologies to help get the job done. So all of us are kind of reading from the same sheet of music, if you will. When you look at the Canada, of course, the common areas concerning off the Arctic, as well in Southeast Alaska. So we have two areas that we have common interests.
Are you coming to D.C. next week?
I'm not one of the many that are going there.
All right.
I've testified a couple times before Congress already. I think I'm taking the lead for a while. And the technology we're using, and I should have said that beforehand, is that the International Maritime Community about 10 years ago came up and required vessels to have transponders much like aircraft. Every couple seconds, the information is going out. The challenge is the Coast Guard did not have the funding to build a receiver. So the information is being disseminated, but not being received and processed. So with the help of the state funding and Exxon Valdez settlement money and the Maritime Ministry and some state Coast Guard money, we were able to compile all this resource together and get a system in place that all of us benefit from. We have a huge system. I traveled to Norway last year and Iceland to kind of compare to see if we're doing world-class tracking. Now, I was a little taken back that Norway, which I think is the creme de creme when you talk about maritime states and Arctic, whatever, they had 35 AIS sites, and we had 120 in this little nonprofit organization out of Juneau. We have a much larger area. We have more comprehensive systems. I was kind of hoping to learn. What I learned is that we're doing pretty well, you know. And similarly with Iceland, is less sites, and yet, you know, so we actually are not. You know, we're taking advantage of, and in many cases, ahead of the curve on this technology. I'm also pleased to say that the state was a big funder and still has been a contributor, but we've really reduced the state's burden. I mean, this example where it should have gone, you gave us the seed money to get up and running, but we're not relying on the state to keep this going. And that's the way we want to move. And so I'm very pleased to say we've reduced you down to about 12% of our overall budget and support. And that, to me, I like to think is a sex story. I don't want to be a continuing burden on the state. I want to be a benefit to the state, but I don't want to be a burden also. Vessel tracking support, the way we're able to do it so cost-effectively with a nonprofit is we partner. We partner with native communities. We work with fish processing plants, fish hatcheries, Coast Guard lighthouses. And so we're really doing it very inexpensively going around. In some cases, we go on mountaintops where we basically find a place and we get permission to go and park something up there. But we're able to do it very efficiently by working with partners and say, can you help us build a maritime safety net? Will you allow us to put some equipment on your property so we can receive these signals, bring it back, and share it with the agencies? So this, and we travel around our little landing craft. We have a 32-foot landing craft. We go on helicopters, float planes, the landing craft. I am actually the senior post hole digger. There's no one's dug more post holes than me. I'm very proud of that title. No one's going to displace me from that. But we'll build these sites, which are, you know, many of them are off-site with solar panels, wind generators, and fuel cells. And some of them get into kind of extreme areas. We're out in Aleutian Islands and using fishing boats and barges and then ATVs, and we get up on top of mountaintops, and then we'll park a vessel tracking site up there, which has a wireless bridge to the GCI HUD and all kinds of interesting arrangements. But basically, it's a network that we're using with other stakeholders to help develop the capability. And then we're looking at vessels 150 miles offshore from the site like that. And how is that information used? In cases such as this, we were able to put an AIS receiver transponder on a state fish and game vessel. And at one point, a fishing vessel was calling for the Coast Guard for help, say, we're going out in the rocks, our engine broke, we're in a storm. Coast Guard looked at the screen, saw the fish and game vessel on scene, said, could you please proceed to that location and grab them? And lives were saved, property was saved, and oil was spilled. This happens all the time. The Coast Guards continually use this. The first thing they look at when there's a search and rescue case is, where's the vessel in distress, and where are the vessels nearby that can help? Because more often than not, it's not a Coast Guard vessel. And so this is continually used for search and rescue. And everything we see, the Coast Guard sees. And it's on live, their screens at other Captain of the Port offices and up at the district all the time. And then we see things such as this, where vessels have a steering casualty. Our watch picks up, notifies the Coast Guard incident, and they follow up with the vessel. We have speed restrictions in certain areas of the state. We actually put an automatic fence, if you will. And so it's kind of like a radar trap. The policeman's out there all the time. It sends an email off the Park Service and says, you're speeding. Guess what? Nobody speeds in Glacier Bay anymore because you all know the policeman's out there with a radar gun 24 hours a day. So it's a great way of compelling compliance. You have to test it once in a while and make sure it's working because nobody's speeding it anymore. So it's hard to make sure it's working right. But we have those electronic fences.
Senator Olson.
So you have regulatory authority?
I'm sorry?
So you have regulatory authority?
No, we don't.
So nobody's fined?
No, we remind them.
Oh, you just remind them. It's not a ticket. It's a warning.
They think it's like Oz behind the curtain. When they hear us call them and we say, you signed and agreed to this, they're like terror. And vessels take a hard right rudder. They come all. It's amazing the maneuvers they take to avoid this. So it's a tremendous way of compelling compliance without actually having a big stick. Shell thought this was a good idea since they got some tickets some time ago for being in the wrong area, one of the vessels, contract vessels. So they have a set up alarm for them. And so we notify the vessel as they approach an area and say, by the way, Shell agreed and you agreed as a subcontractor, stay out of these areas, slow down and head out the other direction. So it's another way of ensuring you're compliant versus just hoping everyone's paying attention.
Last question, Madam Chairman. As you look at the tide that rips pretty fast, you're looking at speeds on a screen. Obviously, lots can influence that. The tide and the wind can do the same thing. I'm assuming you've got compensation for
yes,
that
sir,
as well.
Absolutely.
So not
it's it appears, you know, because we know if the tide's the current time, but not everything. So it appears that you're speeding a particular area. That's all we do. And basically, we're not seeing anything close to that, so it's not a problem. We even had that in the Kodiak Airport where a cruise ship and a plane were sharing the same airspace, so we actually now got alarms that go off so we don't have a cruise ship going in the airspace and reduce visibility conditions. So very unusual applications that going on with cable lines that we also monitor. So many different applications that even I had not anticipated. Of course, you all heard about the barge up in the Arctic. So again, that's one of the situations that using different technology that we also have available. We have a big toolkit of tools. But when we saw the Coast Guard was flying all the way up the Arctic every day to look at this barge, we suggested it might be an easier way. We've done this in the past, and I realize it's not a pretty thing, but it proved but effective. This is basically sandbags to hold this thing on and just drop it from a helicopter, small transponder. I've used it to track my daughter canoeing down the Yukon River, so I know it works. We have a bunch of them anyway. But we dropped on the barge, and so we were watching that barge as it's going across the Arctic and now in Russian waters. But it saves a lot of time and effort. You know, a lot of angst, a lot of money. It's all averted because this thing just pings automatically. We use the same thing for ADC when they have shellfish farming. Sometimes the inspector can't go with the shellfish to validate they're going to the right locations. They don't get underway. They just put a transponder on the vessels. They can go and can validate them with the right areas. So we're using technology to facilitate not just environmental protection or safety, but just facilitate commerce or fishing, what have you. Similarly, there have been some concerns about the traffic that here before didn't exist in the Arctic waters and potentially impacting the local mariners. And so we're able to develop some technologies, and we work with the NGOs on this, and now we're working on ExxonMobil, but we designed this and tested it on our boat, a little packet transponder. So these vessels can see every large vessel can see these small 18-foot skiffs every bit clearly as if it was a super tanker in front of them. Shows up on the screen. They know who it is. Information is passed back and forth, so we can track the whalers, we can track the big ships, and can avoid, minimize the consequence of having a collision because they both know each other's existence. So, again, we're using technology in different areas, and now, of course, we're moving to the Arctic, so we're working in applications up there. And just examples of how the data, we can play back the data and historically, and this is used for risk assessments and port planning by the Army Corps of Engineers, the Coast Guard ports, port access route studies and other studies that they have, they use this information. We continually get requests for information for laying down traffic lanes or port assessments or understanding the nature of the trade and the risks. It's pretty hard to manage risk if you don't know what it looks like in the first place. And so the Arctic is clearly letting people question what kind of ships, where are they going, how close to shore. And so we provide that information. We're the source of, when you look at these Washington, D.C. reports, they're coming from the Marine Exchange as far as the reports we can generate in there. And we can show the trends of how many vessels are going north and south and where they're going, what have you. And as recently, the trend has gone down because oil exploration efforts have been put on stall for a period of time, and I'm sure they'll pick up this year. But at least we can see what's going on, and we understand it, and we can manage something that we understand.
Sure.
Yes, Senator Olson.
Sir, Captain Page, can we go back to the previous, sure, two slides before that? Is the majority of the traffic, the marine traffic there, going on our side of the Diomede Islands or on their side of the Diomede Islands?
Most of it's going on our side because we have the local traffic for us, tug and tows, sure, and, of course, the vessel's going to Red Dog Mine. And that's predominantly what our traffic is, tug and tows, and vessels going to Red Dog. Except in this year, it was 2013, I guess. That would have been also oil exploration support and survey vessels.
Is that because it's our land, our waters, or is it because there's a deeper area there between in the streets?
They're about the same. I think really the Russians stay on their side and we stay on our side. They just feel comfortable staying on our respective sides, and that's what you see there. The Russian side just can stay on that side, go to the Northern Sea Route or some other place along the way for the most part. And the detail of information is all generated by AIS is pretty incredible. We have a tremendous amount of detail on destination port, you know, last port of call, dimension, speed. All information is compiled and evaluated and shared with other agencies, what have you. In this particular case, it just kind of shows the list of vessels over a period of time, and the majority of them were Red Dog, or a good percentage were Red Dog cargo ships, as opposed to the Northern Sea Route traffic. We can also show the area that of the straits that they're transiting. Again, Senator Olson, you can see that once again that most of the traffic is on our side of the strait. And that's northbound is the blue, obviously, and southbound is the red. And the traffic density is not all that terrific, so it's manageable. However, I think that the best time to lock the barn door is before the horse gets out. So I think putting protective measures in now is the right way to go than to wait till things go wrong and then start doing some damage control efforts. Interest in passenger vessels, we can break that down so we can only show one class of vessels if need be. This is kind of the type of trade we're seeing. Fishing vessels, research vessels, cargo vessels, military vessels, tankers, yachts, tugs, offshore supply vessels. So we talk about the makeup of trade, it's a conglomeration of vessels, and of course the passenger vessels. And contrast, I always like to benchmark, we contrast that. In Juneau, we have 7,000 vessels transit a year right by our area. So you can manage traffic and keep the risk down. The tools are there to do that. But we also have the same problems down in other parts of Alaska. And I use this slide to talk about domain awareness. Because I was asked to give a talk about that. So that's interesting. It didn't say maritime, so it gives me more latitude. But the issue here really comes down to is there's one thing to know where each other is, if you will, and that's domain awareness. But the next big question comes in, whose domain is it? You know, you're holding a license, that means it's your domain, or you got a bigger teeth and claws, but then I have pepper spray, and it go back and forth. In the maritime region, it's a big question as far as whether you're on innocent passage, going from one foreign port to another foreign port, transit passage from a U.S. port to a foreign port, you know, whether you're in state waters out to 3 or territorial seas at 12 or exclusive economic zone out to 200. So the flag of the vessel, the nature of the trade, voyage, all those things come into play as far as domain awareness. And the next challenge is it's only worthwhile if you do something about it. So it's really domain management. If you're not managing the domain, why be even aware of it? It's just frustrating. And so we looked at the Sullivan IU incident. We didn't have domain awareness. We didn't know there was a problem. And nor did we have any management procedures in place. It was just transient through. We had no regulation to have to comply with. Just go through. So today, that's changed. We do have domain awareness, and we have domain management. Here's another example of a ship in a very high-risk event, close to an island out in the Aleutian Islands. If anything went wrong on the vessels, there's nothing you can do about it. Nobody ever get there for days. There's no domain awareness, and there is, in this case, domain awareness, but no domain management. So if you have the information but not do anything with it, it's worthless. Yep. So my push these days is moving to the maritime domain management beyond the awareness side of it. Here's an example of a vessel, and I'll show you this a little bit later, where now it's towing the line. Very high-risk transit. No one would do that. They're just interested in seeing Alaska. They have time to kill. But it's not, as you can see, that's a 700-foot bulk carrier. It's not a passenger vessel. It's not a tour vessel. And these are the type of events that can lead to, you know, the incidents in the future.
So why?
Yes, sir.
Senator Stevens.
Why are they going through Shelikov Strait instead of off Kodiak? That makes no sense at all.
Yes, sir. I agree, Senator. It makes no sense at all. And all they can think of, and unfortunately, been there, done that to some extent. I've been curious, too, when I've on ships, you know, sightseeing and looking things. I have a little better motive. I could say I'm looking for illegal fisheries or whatever. But if you're in transit, go to A to B, and all your cargo interests don't want you being a tour guide or enjoying yourselves. They want you to deliver that in the most efficient way. And so nobody knows. So they show up. They had no idea they were serpentining through the Aleutian Islands and having a good old time. So these are things that we didn't know 10 years ago. We absolutely had no idea this was happening. And now we do. So now we need to do something about it.
Yeah.
And we are. And one of the things, a spinoff of the Marine Exchange, is what we call the network. It's Alaska Maritime Prevention Response Network. I started on the president of it. I started that because the complexity now, we enrolled 2,000 vessels this last year in a network, which agreed to these risk reduction measures. And the management of that, I was getting calls all night long from Greece and Singapore. They don't look at their clock and figure out what the time it is in Juneau, Alaska. And so we have a separate office in Anchorage that manages this aspect of just the coordination of talking to vessels and the procedures and what have you. But the operations center, the nerve center, is right here in Juneau at the Marine Exchange. So it basically broke down. And this total operation I'm talking about, 120 sites, the network, it's 25 people. 25 people. And so this network now is regulating on Western Alaska out to 200 miles out at sea. It's telling vessels and the reason why we're doing this network is the Coast Guard has some regulations as far as you have to have oil spill response equipment everywhere you go. We said, you've never applied that in Alaska. You've always waived it, you know, and we're going to do is provide an alternative so we can say, we understand the objective of the pollution prevention regulations, but if I use an analogy, we're probably better off having airbags, ABS brakes, speed limits, enforcement, and a couple of ambulances than a whole bunch of ambulances and no safety measures. So we still have the oil spill response equipment. In fact, the network purchased over $1.5 million of equipment last year, oil spill response. But our focus and emphasis has been on prevention. We've done many things in the prevention side of it, more so for that matter.
Yes, Senator.
Yes, sir.
On that map, yes, sir. This blip here, is that in Russian territory and not U.S.? Or what?
Well, it's just basically, it's just where you push off the islands. We're still 200 miles offshore, but it's a Pribilof that influenced the line, quite honestly. We're able to push out further because of Pribilof Islands. So it's really just 200 miles push for something we own.
So we don't worry about that area.
That's the donut hole we used to refer to as far as fishing. There was a no-man land with international waters. Vessels would go there and haul a fish out until we have international treaties. Say, this is not good because the neighboring countries are impacted by that. But that was the donut hole. It still is a donut hole, but it's now regulated donut hole by treaty as opposed to it's no-man's land.
But you do not track vessels in that area?
No, sir. No. I'm sorry, Chair?
Yeah.
No, okay. So we talked about the size of Alaska compared to lower 48. Obviously, the challenges of complying are great. We looked at environmental conditions. The conventional means of picking up oil spills are really aren't effective. We're better off preventing. The limited infrastructure and ability to support, you know, oil spill response capabilities everywhere we go. In fact, the only places in Alaska where the Coast Guard regulation can fully be met are Cook Inlet and Prince William Sound, because the rest is just too big and too expansive. And you can't be on scene in 24 hours everywhere in Alaska with oil spill boom, which is really not going to answer the mail anyway. So, and as even the Coast Guard says, that the best, you know, response is really prevention. Prevention is the best response. So we're really focused on the prevention side. We have this alternative planning criteria that talks about preventing. Our key components of this are having information, time, and capabilities. Information, obviously, the Marine Exchange provides information. If you don't know a vessel is stressed, it doesn't matter if you have capabilities, if you have time. You need to know where the vessel is. You know it's in, you need to know it has trouble. And so we have alarms go off all the time when we see something that looks like anomaly. In the wrong area, reduce speed. We contact the vessel right away. So what's the problem? And then we confer with the Coast Guard and the state as appropriate. The other idea is time. If we learn a vessel's in trouble, but they're 1 mile offshore, can't do anything about it. So we force vessels offshore routing. We say a commercial vessel can stay 50 miles offshore and only go certain transit points. That gives us time to do something. And lastly, the capabilities. There are tugs and other vessels available. We enhance the capabilities. You need to know where they are. Where are those tugs? What are their capabilities? And the sooner you know that information, the more effective they can be. If you have to start searching, spending hours searching, calling an office in Seattle at 2 o'clock in the morning Saturday, you're out of luck. So all that stuff is what the network and the Marine Exchange are providing at this point. I'm going to skip that slide. It's too busy. But this is basically risk mitigating measures. These are the routes the vessel allowed to go through, the red areas. If they go in those red areas, they get contacted immediately by the Marine Exchange. We have their cell phone, we have satellite phones, we have their email addresses, they have the corporate offices, we have a whole list of names, so we will get hold of that vessel quickly. If they don't, we're going to be talking to head management about it. So it works very well. This extends all up the Arctic, which is your concern, but we've taken the model and solutions in other parts of Alaska, and now we're exporting and expanding them up into the Arctic. This ship I showed you before with a high-risk event, the high-risk of transit, that was it a couple months ago before we implemented these measures. This is the same vessel afterwards. So it basically got the message. Can't keep on doing that. Okay? This is a vessel that's not under command. We contacted them. As you can stop, it's a little red dot. It stopped. It's AIS shows not under command. We contact them right away in the Coast Guard. Here's a vessel that was not authorized to transit in U.S. waters. We contacted the Coast Guard, let them know. They got hold of the ship, and the vessel diverted. Another ship that was entering U.S. waters, not authorized, it diverted. Here's a vessel going through the wrong pass. We contact them, they divert it. And these are classic messages we send to the Coast Guard, a graphic and an explanation of an incident. Last year, there were 450 vessels we found not compliant with the law that we notified the Coast Guard, and it was about 10 a day, or sometimes 20 a day. Now it's down to one a week. So we're basically influencing behavior, if you will. We also have emergency response database, so when things go wrong, we can immediately locate the tugs and their capabilities. And as I mentioned beforehand, Senator Olson had mentioned something about enforcement authority, and we're kind of similar to these speed zones along the highway. They work. This guy has his brake lights on, and he works for me. I told him to go 40, but he decided to pay attention to that sign, which says, not connected to the police department, doesn't spit out tickets. Doesn't spit out his payroll either, his paycheck, but he's listening to the sign roll over me. So, you know, we're reminding people what the rules are, and it works. So what we've been doing, been enhancing spill response equipment, spill prevention connection capabilities, adding both our prevention and response capabilities, which being applied into the Arctic. And there's a 5-year plan as to how we grow and further enhance maritime safety throughout Alaska. As I mentioned before, in 2,000 vessels enrolled, we've added more AIS sites, some of which are now funded by the network. We've got a cooperative research and development agreement with the Coast Guard. I'll talk about that in a minute, called the Next Generation Arctic Next Generation Navigational Safety Information System. We procured over $1 million worth of spill response equipment. This is a little dated slide. This example of how many vessels were not compliant in one day here back in last February. And now you're seeing it down to a couple vessels. You see in July it was 2 vessels or 3 vessels, and now we have nothing to show you because people are getting the word. We're also sending information out to vessels on environmental information. We're working with Alaska Ocean Observing System to provide that capability. And so now vessels can, we have different sensor sites, and then vessels can basically push a button on their chart, and it'll show them the environmental information. And that could be ice, that could be weather condition, whatever. Again, information that can use to ensure safe transit. So we're building the sites, developing the software, and now have the broadcast station. We're sending information out to vessels. And so they click on an icon in this particular case, and they have information. And we have 28 of those sites we've built in Alaska. And this is coincides and works very closely with the Coast Guard's create a cooperative research and development agreement. So they're trying to work. We entered with that with them. We're working the R&D center in, back in New London, Connecticut. We don't get paid by the Coast Guard. It's simply we pay everything out of our own pockets, but we're moving technology forward. But where we see this going, and we've been doing with our icebreaker, sending messages out from these sites, that we can start, we are actually right now have virtual aids and navigation buoys. We can't put them in ice because ice just takes them away. So we've done that in Cook Inlet, put a virtual aid to navigation where you normally pull the buoys out and they disappear. We got them virtually on their charts. So they'll show up in the chart plotter on the ship. We can show location of whalers and environmental data, location of whales, vessels in distress, areas to be avoided. So a lot of information we can pass these vessels are now entering our waters. We can communicate the risks and information. And you know, most recently, and I know that Senator McGuire is aware of this one, is that we've had an incident just south of our border a little while ago that's got the Canadians very interested because they realized they got kind of, as the media said, dumb luck saved the day, you know. And they just happened to see this vessel. They didn't have offshore routing measures. They didn't have active monitoring systems. And they just luckily discovered this and respond in time and keep this vessel from flowing ashore, soiling the shores with oil and what have you. But I think this is a good example of the disparities as far as what's in place and what's not in place and why they're interested in doing what we're doing. We have our own gaps in parts of Alaska. Southeast Alaska, we're still trying to work and find the same capabilities we've done in Western Alaska. That's an issue we're still working with the Coast Guard. But certainly Canada understands it, and I think most of Alaska has this in place. And we have still some work to do, and I think we'll work with DEC and others to you know, get these capabilities. But I think the good thing to know is that when we talk about the increased shipping that's going to come along with activities in the Arctic, that we have a toolbox now that we didn't have a couple of years ago to actually manage our maritime domain and communicate risk to vessels and see what's going on. So some of that should release some angst from a lot of folks. And if things do go wrong, we can implement a response much more quickly when we know when it happens and we know where the resources are. So I think that basically I'm talking about maritime domain awareness moving to the management scheme, the risk mitigating measures I talked about beforehand as far as offshore routing and notification of incidents and monitoring and ensuring compliance with these risk mitigating measures, the response network, which is being expanded, and then using technology as a force multiplier to actually get this done, which otherwise it'd be, I don't know how we didn't do it, quite honestly, without technology. It's a great force multiplier. So those are kind of my slides. I know you both have heard and in the past been exposed to marine exchange, but this is kind of an update, and we're still moving forward. There's still a lot more to do. We're really appreciative of the support that the state has provided us over the years, and hopefully you feel it's a good return on your investment, too. That
we do.
Tampa State.
Thank you so much, Captain Page. Any questions?
Just very briefly, Madam Chair. Could you talk about the state involvement in the investment we have made, and now it's down to, like, you think, I think 14%, and what are we looking at? We're cutting every budget in place. I want to make sure that we protect yours.
I appreciate that comment there, Senator. We're not in the budget this year at all, and we're hoping to get reintroduced in the budget. The funding stream that we've used in the past, which seems to fit well, is the cruise ship head tax funds, which is really a burden, restricted to certain applications. Either directly contributes to the safety or oversight of cruise ships, or has a benefit to the whole maritime community. So it's not something you could build other or direct to schools or anywhere else. It's really got to be directed to it. And we use a percentage of that cruise ship head tax funds. And, of course, we do monitor cruise ships for environmental compliance. It's one of the tools we use here. This also is a safety tool. If something goes wrong with the cruise ship, we'll know exactly where it is, and we'll know where all the rescue vessels are, And so it aids maritime safety for cruise ships, but also enhances and benefits the whole maritime community. So unfortunately, we're not in the budget right now. We're hoping to get reinstituted. It's about $500,000 a year is what we'll be getting the past couple of years. So hoping that gets somehow, either through legislature or the administration, gets back in the budget. That's what we've used in the past. And but again, I'm really pleased to say that we've really diminished our reliance on the state. And that's the message I want to leave with you, that I'm not trying to lean on the state, or especially in these times.
Thank you. And Senator, I wanted to note too, Senator Gardner is the alternate to our committee, so she'll be here through all the committee hearings. Did you have any questions, Senator Gardner?
No, I enjoyed this very much. And my only concern is that the copies we got seem to be missing the last 4 or 5 pages.
Oh, okay.
Will they be posted online?
We'll get you. Yeah, we'll get you.
These are small, and if we can look online, it's easier anyway.
Perfect.
They're already posted.
They're already posted, and we'll get you a better copy. Thank you so much, Captain Page. Maybe we'll take a field trip and come down.
I love it.
All right, we're adjourned.